Just wanted to announce that tonight we will be passing the basket, and the money is donated to the local clubhouses in Palm Beach, Broward, and Dade County. So we'll be passing the baskets after our speaker. We have the opportunity and the honor of listening to lots of tapes and CDs from speakers from around the country. And every now and then, you know, you just put one on and 3 minutes into it, you go, this person's got an incredible message. And I had the honor of calling Angie and asking her if she would come down and join us in Florida. And a couple of weeks prior to her coming down, some circumstances that happened that kind of put her life in a little bit of an upheaval. So you're going to see the love that comes out of this woman tonight. You're going to feel it for yourselves. So I ask you as members and fellowships to put some love out to her because she could use a little bit of help when we send her back to Cincinnati. On the way back, when we picked her up at the airport, we had quite a few laughs in the car. And as only Angie can do, we were talking about the program. She was like, yeah, I got it, you got it. And I can't do that head bob thing that she does. But she's an amazing woman with an incredible story. So please, warm welcome for Angie from Cincinnati.
Hi, everybody. My name is Angie, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I'd like to thank the committee for having me here. Like Sandy said, it's been an interesting 2 weeks, and I had a place to come to here, and I'll be forever thankful for those of you who reached out your hand to help me this weekend. And where's my Florida girls? I love you guys. And there was a guy that I really really got close to. It's like you meet people and you just hit it off with them. And his name is Lynn. And he's been really, really good to me. And I just, you know, we went down and we had a pedicure together. He got me a pedicure. And you know, we had great conversation. And then the woman cut my toe. She did. She cut my toe, and then she gave me a lecture afterwards about the importance of keeping my feet so you know how good my feet look. She lectured me after she was done with them. But I wanted to say something to Sandy and Steve, and I appreciate you picking me up from the airport. And, you know, one of the cool things about coming to a different town is people ask me all the time, did you travel with anyone? And the reason why I don't is because if I traveled with people, I would spend more time with the people that I traveled with, as opposed to sitting down and getting to know some people that I don't know. And that's something that I hadn't done in my sobriety, is reached out to other people. So I'm really just really grateful to be here. But this is fabulous right here. All this, I called back home. I came in and took a picture. And I said, see how they do it? This is what we need, Ohio. So I'm really glad to be here. But let me tell you a little bit about myself. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me to disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. And I need to tell you that I'm originally from Greenville, South Carolina. And back, thank you very much, some of my relatives. And I we lived on in a little white house on a red clay road, and we got our water out of wells, and we had an outhouse, and we picked blackberries for fun, and I didn't even wear shoes until I got to the city. And life was simple. I mean, we drank buttermilk, ate cornbread all the time. You know, I wish to tell you that I do none of those things now. But that was the way it was, and we had a very simple life. I'm from a family of Baptist ministers, and I had flaming red hair and freckles in my family, and nobody else in my family did. Imagine that. And and one day I was out at the outhouse, and my brother, we were playing, and I went into the outhouse, and he locked me in, and he goes, I got you in here because I know why you look the way you do. And I said, why? And he said, because the mailman, your daddy. So whenever I would see the mailman coming down the street, I'd be like, daddy. Oh, there go my daddy. And he put his arms around me and pat me on my head and tell me how cute I am and how cute I was. And thank God for the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps and the traditions, because I found out that turned out to be a little pattern for me, actually, that if you just put your arms around me and pat me on my head and tell me how cute I was, we were basically married at that point. We stayed down south for a little while, and my dad got transferred to Cincinnati, Ohio, and he moved up there, and in the process of traveling back and forth, he had got himself a little girlfriend, and so he still moved us to Cincinnati, Ohio, but he went to live up the hill from us, and that left my mother to raise us. And my mother is mentally ill, and she doesn't believe in taking medication, and what she has a tendency to do sometimes is just disappear. And you know, as I talk to you now, my mother is missing. And one of the reasons why I love Alcoholics Anonymous is because you guys had no idea really what I had been going through. But for those of you that came up and put your arms around me, just because it's something that you do, I'll be forever grateful. That you just came up to me when I was sitting there trying to figure out how I could find my mother, that you came and you just put your arms around me. See, I believe that that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. When you see someone sitting by themselves, because sometimes what we have a tendency to do, you know, we come to these things and we all group up and we got our cliques and we do our thing. But in Ohio, we're taught that if we see somebody sitting by themselves, we need to go over and greet them. And for the people that came to greet me this weekend, I will be forever thankful, because it was your words and your prayers that got me through this weekend thus far. So I am extremely, extremely grateful. So we move up to Cincinnati, Ohio. My mother was always a stickler for education. I mean, we couldn't use the word ain't. We couldn't use any of that in our household. And what my mother told me was that because we were black, we would have a harder time in life. Now, my brother and my sister got that. What that meant for me was that I would always be less than white people. It's an area that God's been working with me on, because I seem to speak at a lot of these things where it's a whole lot of white people. I mean, it's a few of us out there. Could you raise your hand? Beautiful. Good to see you. Good to see you. And if you're African-American in this room, you should feel special as hell. You know why? Because it's like being chocolate chips just floating in a big-ass glass of milk. You know what I mean? You should feel special. If you're new in the room, first of all, I'm glad that you're here. We have a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got a very serious thing going, and it's called the disease of alcoholism. And if you're new and you're here, and for the sister that got the book last night, is she here? Maybe not. Maybe not. Are you here? Okay, yeah, the one laying down. I must tell you that I got the book when I got sober. I got the book at the conference, and I'm still here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my mother decided that, you know, she wanted us to go to Catholic schools. So now I had a big red afro, freckles, a white blouse, a plaid skirt, black and white Spaldens and bobby socks, and I got beat up on a regular basis. You know what I mean? Because it didn't look normal. It really didn't. I mean, when I looked in the mirror, I thought, I was like, what the hell? You know? I hadn't seen anybody who looked like me. I didn't see anybody, a black person with red hair and freckles, until I came to AA. And I ran in that clubhouse when I saw him, and I ran up to him. I was like, man, where you been? Left me all out here by myself. Give me a hug. And so I went to this Catholic school, and I got beat up, like I said, all the time. And there was this girl named Squeaky. She was like 6'10", like in the fifth grade. And she hung out with her little posse, and one day they stoned me on the way home from school. I couldn't believe it. I was like, they are actually throwing stones at me. And I ran in the house, and I told my mother, I said, whoo, I'm glad I made it in the house, honey, because they were about to kill me out there. And I knew whenever my mother sounded like this that she meant business. She said, you know, Angela, at some point you got to learn how to stand up for yourself. So I want you to go back out there and you stand up to Squeaky. I said, you want me to do what? She said, you go out there and you stand up to Squeaky, or you stay in here and get the butt whooping that I'm going to give you now. I knew what my mother's felt like, but I only knew what Squeaky's appeared to be. So I went out to the parking lot and she was standing there all big. And I said, my mother said, I'm supposed to fight you. And she said, well, come on in. So I bowed my fist up. And I closed my eyes as tight as I could. And I knew I had to reach up. So I just reached. I got it right here. It was the happiest day of my damn life. It really was. I had hit the giant. Now, let me tell you, now after I hit her, she didn't budge when I hit her. Let's get that out of the way first of all. And I said, you about to kill me, ain't you? And she goes, yeah. And she gave me the big beat down. But I got this thing called alcoholism that helps me remember what I should forget and forget what I should remember. So I forgot the fact that she gave me the big beat down, and what I remembered was that I hit her. And from that point on, I became a boxer. I started fighting everybody. I mean, just for that. When I got sober in Cincinnati, I came into that meeting. I told him, hey, don't mess with me. I have hurt people. Don't mess with me. But then, you know, you work some steps. You incorporate them traditions in your life. And you got to get a little honest about some things. So the reason they called me the knockout queen, that's what they did. So I would tell everybody in AA, don't mess with me. I ain't working no steps. I'm the knockout queen. I will knock you out. And, you know, once I started doing a little step work, a little service work, all that good stuff. Well, the reason why they called me that was because every time somebody hit me, they knocked my ass clean out. So, you know, I had to get honest about that eventually. And one day my mother came. We lived in the projects when we got to Cincinnati. And my mother came and got me from school on my 12th birthday. And my mother had got a new job with a company called Avon. And she began to make some more money. And so she took us to this neighborhood. And she said, this is our new house. Beautiful red brick house. My mother still lives there. And it was in an all-white neighborhood. And so for the first probably, 13 to about 20, I wasn't even black no more. I listened to Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. My favorite girl group was Heart. And the first concert I ever went to was Led Zeppelin 1979, baby. Listen, I was at the Ted Nugent Foreigner concert one night, right? And Foreigner singing, you know it. I have waited a lifetime. Sailed across the stormy sea. If that, oh my God, I looked around and said, okay, come on now. Y'all ready to dance already? It's later. And I look around this entire Coliseum and I don't see one black person. I was like, I am bad, and you know I'm bad. And you know it, if you were around that time, you know we all had air guitars. And that's what I did all the time, just walking around the neighborhood. And my father used to keep things real simple. He would just look at me and go, something is wrong with you. So I started hanging out with these girls, these five white girls. They could do anything they wanted to do. I couldn't believe it. One day I was at my friend Rebecca's house, and her mother called a family meeting. I said, what the hell? She goes, Rebecca. That's my white woman voice. Rebecca. Your father and I have been communicating. And we understand, Rebecca, that there's been some alcohol consumption. Your father and I have been speaking about it, Rebecca, and what we would like is that if you're going to drink, we would appreciate it if you would drink at home. I said, what did your mother just say? She goes, oh, yeah, it's okay if we drink at home because she thinks it's safer. I was like, oh my God, that is the closest family I ever met. I remember going home to my mother going, can I have a beer? And she was like, not in this lifetime, honey. And so I hung out with these girls, and Rebecca, she came over to my house one night. She had a brown bag, two bottles, gave me one. Boone's Farm apple wine. Oh, for God's sake, people, let it go. Let it go. Now, you know what? I talk at my church on a regular basis, and when I tell them that I drank Boone's Farm, they don't have that reaction. As a matter of fact, if anything, they feel such pity for me when I tell them that. But no, you come to a function of Alcoholics Anonymous, and guess what? You mentioned Boone's Farm, and everybody's like, ooh, ooh. So she gave me my bottle. She told me that her brothers had schooled her in the art of chugging, and we began to chug this bottle. I had mine and she had hers, and I must tell you that I know something happened to me that did not happen to Rebecca, because I began to drink this alcohol and swallow it, and it went to the bottom of my feet, this warm feeling. And it rose slowly through my entire body. And by the time it reached my head, I knew without a shadow of a doubt that that was something I was going to do on a regular basis. I already knew. I could not believe it. Oh, my God. My hair changed colors. Freckles just started flying off. Shoo! I was funny. Rebecca beat me up that night. You know what I mean? It's just all that you know. And I began to do this on a regular basis. Now, I must tell you that I mean no disrespect to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel like I'm a member in good standing. But there are some drugs in my story. Breathe. I did a little marijuana, couldn't really do that. It seemed like I just smoked it and ate everything in everybody's freezer that had been there for forever. And I, you know, did a little acid. It got me a mental health diagnosis. But I have to tell you this, one night I was with my friend Rebecca, and she, you know, had a couple pieces of paper, and, you know, she gave them to me, told me just to eat the one piece, but, you know, I ate the two. And it was actually, it was strawberry mescaline. And we're driving, you guys are so funny, we're driving down the road, I'm driving, and all of a sudden, something happened, and things became extremely colorful. And it was almost like the birds were flying low and waving. And the car appeared to me as if it just floated, and they decided that they wanted to get something from McDonald's, and so we pulled into McDonald's. It was such a, just a really beautiful trip, and got to the little yellow box, and there's some person in there yelling at me. What do you want? What do you want? That's what they're asking me in the little yellow box. What do you want? What, ma'am? What do you want? I said, oh, no, brother. What do you want? What do you want, buddy? Now, I'm not a good fighter, but he was only about this big. I was sure I could whoop him. You see what I'm saying? So I'm, you know, going through my whole, and see, and this is why I don't do them. This is why I don't do them. And so, you know, I go around and somebody's asking me for my money, whatever, and we get to the next window and some guy's pushing bags in. I'm pushing them right back at him. And, you know, and so they called the police, rightfully so. They called him rightfully so. And the police came and, you know, asked me my name, and I told him it was, you know, Luke Skywalker. And you know, they asked me to pull my car around because I naturally was probably going to go to jail. And my car wouldn't go. And the officer kept going, I told you to pull over there. And I mean right now. And I was like, you know what, officer, just go ahead and put the cuffs on me, would you? Because I already know what's about to happen. And I went to jail, and they called my parents and told them that they had me, you know, in jail. And my parents, you know, kindly said, well, make sure that she's warm, and hung up. You know, I just didn't have those kind of parents that says, oh my God, we're going to go get, we'll be there, honey. My parents were not like that at all. They said, oh, did she? Okay, great. Well, we'll see her when she gets out. And that was the story of my deal, actually. And so I started to hang out with these girls. We went to bars and everything. And I've been singing since I was three. And my dad had got me a job at a recording studio. And I was in the bathroom one day doing my best Whitney. And I don't know, if you're an artist like me, you just know someday somebody is going to hear me sing. And they're going to have a contract in their back pocket. And they're going to want me to open up at the Grammys. It's just, you know what I mean? It's just the way it was going to work out. So I'm in this bathroom and I'm cleaning and I'm singing and I hit my best Whitney note. And I walk outside and there's a tall gentleman standing there. And he said, was that you? I said, well, as a matter of fact, it was. He said, I can make you famous. I said, for real? He goes, yeah, I know people. I was like, great. He said, but you'll have to come to Las Vegas. No problem. So I went home and I called a family meeting. Didn't quite go like Rebecca's. Because my mother was like, oh Lord, what is it now? You know, and my father's like, something is wrong with you. And I told him, I said, I'll be back for you all. Once I get my first Grammy, I shall return and you never have to live in poverty again. And my mom's going, we don't live in poverty. But I had to come and get them from somewhere, you know what I mean? So my little sister's saying to me, Angie, please don't go. And my brother's saying, Angie, please don't go. But I got to go. You know why? Because he said those magic words, I can make you famous. Not me. He can make me famous. And so I went out to Las Vegas, Nevada, and I was a young girl opening up for some of the biggest stars and having the time of my life. I'm drinking. Alcohol is flowing freely. And that's all I did was drink and sing. Well, this gentleman that I went with that I knew absolutely nothing about had a little affliction himself. He had a little heroin problem. And so he introduced me to that at the age of 19. And so now here I am with somebody I don't know out in Las Vegas, drinking and singing and shooting dope and just going down and clueless and absolutely clueless. But something strange, it might not happen in Florida, but something strange started to happen. I began to not remember things when I drank. I know you guys have never experienced it, but just... You know, waking up next to Pete, you know what I mean? We're both looking at each other going, damn, you know what I mean? You know, and he's got one tooth and it's gold, you know what I'm saying? And he's saying things to me like, you told me you loved me last night. And I said, oh, Zeb, I'm sure I did, but it's not going to happen. And so things began to happen, and I began to black out. And I'll tell you, it wasn't until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever heard that the first drink was the problem. That was new news to me. Because people were telling me, Angie, just drink two. Don't drink beer. Drink wine. Smoke weed before you drink. You know, all of those recipes, you know, like how they talk about in the book. You know, the same stuff. And we began to just go down. And it got to the point where I had began to get blacklisted in casinos, where I couldn't get a singing job. Because when I put alcohol in my body, I'd like to tell you that I know what's going to happen. But usually what happens is that I'm on stage singing in front of some really well-to-do people. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm drinking on the set. And then I come back after the break and I'm drunk and I'm taking my shirt off going, feelings. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You know what I mean? So I began to get blacklisted because they don't like, you know, for you to do that in anywhere, I think. And I began to just spiral down with this gentleman, and we were getting deeper into the stuff, and we were living in some seedy hotel, and one day he came and got me after he had went out and did whatever he did, and he came and got me, and he told me that he needed me to drive to the store, that he was going to run in and get something and come back out. And when he went in and he shot and killed the owner of the store, and he robbed the place. And He came out, you know, if you're new in the room, I'm going to share something with you real quick. This story right here kept me sick for many, many years. I told you everything but that. Because I just knew in my heart of hearts that if you knew I had been involved in something like that, that you would not want to know me in any kind of way. And here I am out here, just a little country girl from South Carolina. See, and what I'm trying to get you to see is the powerfulness of the disease of alcoholism. Because I know if I wouldn't have been drinking, I would have never been involved in that. And he came out of that store and he had all of this blood on him. And the only thing I could do when he told me to drive was to drive. And they caught us about 10 blocks down the road. And it seemed like that I took a drink of alcohol at the age of 13 with my friend Rebecca. And now I'm sitting on trial for complicity to murder. And I'm listening to these people tell me all of this stuff about myself, telling me how bad of a person I was, how I was a lowlife, how I didn't have any regards for life. But let me tell you something. If you're the alcoholic of my variety, they sat there and they told me that stuff over and over again. But it never, ever bothered me that much. You know why? Because it wasn't anything I hadn't called myself. It wasn't anything I hadn't called myself. And I need to tell you that this gentleman is still in prison as we speak. And here I am in Florida at a convention. I don't know. I got booted out of Nevada. I can't go back to Nevada. If somebody called me and asked me to speak, I can't go. Because that letter from the governor, which is called a floater, said, don't you bring your ass back here. Now, don't you come back here. The way I read it was, you, as long as you're black and you ain't going to change colors, don't come back to Las Vegas. So, I haven't found it necessary to go back. You know, I don't even watch stuff on TV about Las Vegas. That's how scared I am. And so I go through this whole ordeal, and I ended up getting out of that, getting the floater, and going back to Cincinnati. And when I got back to Cincinnati, I promised my family that I would do something different. And I meant that from the bottom of my heart. Let me share with you that there's people that have a hard time getting sober. And I truly understand that. But I'm going to tell you something. Every single time that I said I was going to stop drinking, I meant that from the bottom of my heart. I meant it from the bottom of my heart. What I didn't know was that I had alcoholism and that it dictated and managed my life. And it told me where I would go and what I would do. But I would tell my family time and time again, I'm not going to do it no more, and I meant it. But to the untrained eye, we appear liars. And that's what I appeared to my family, was just a liar. And I'm going to tell you something. I began, one day my brother and sister and I, we're on the city bus. You could ride it all over the city on Sundays, and it was called Sunday Pass Riding. And we got downtown Cincinnati, and it was at the corner of Liberty and Vine, and there was a little restaurant there, and I looked over there. Oh, it was lit up, and it was pimps and with big hats and prostitutes. And I remember my little sister looking over there going, oh, boy, you couldn't pay me to go over there. And my brother talking about, shoot, me neither. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm going over there tomorrow. That's the difference. That's the difference in my thinking and my brother and sister's thinking. I had to get over there. They didn't want to go. So I started traveling on the city bus downtown, hanging out with my friends. My people got me. My friend's name was No Neck, Greasy Feet, and Tie Dye. My friends. Boy, I thought they were brilliant. You know what they taught me how to do? I don't know what your friends taught you, but this is what my friends taught me. My friends taught me how to go in a department store with a girdle on, roll up outfits, stick them all around, put your coat on, and walk out. I thought they was brilliant. And then we go sell it to some guy for the remarkably low price. And I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that they came up with this on their own. And so I hung out with these guys, and we drank. And by this time, I'm drinking wine. I'm, you know, not top shelf anymore. It's Wild Irish Rose. You know, I know you guys don't know about this down in Miami. You know what I mean? I'm sure you, Ziffendale or something. But it ain't wine to me unless you can slap it on the bottom and then cricket. And it ain't wine to me unless a grape ain't been near it. And that's what I drank with my friends. And I began to hang out with these guys, and I began to do all this stuff. And I'll tell you what, I started getting arrested, because it's hard not to get arrested when you go into people's store trying to steal under the influence of alcohol. You know what I mean? I remember when I first got sober, I was over at my dad's house one day and I was talking and I was on the phone. I was like, yeah, you know, I used to be a hustler and everything. I used to make big money, you know, I had big cars, you know, a lot of gold and stuff. And, you know, I just quit since I've been in recovery. I don't choose to hustle anymore. So I got off the phone and my father said, did y'all hear you just tell somebody you were a hustler? He said, no, baby, let me explain to you. A hustler actually makes money. What you are, my dear, is a fool. And there's a difference. He said, no, don't mess up the hustler thing. You are not a hustler. So I'm going and stealing. And one day, boom, I get arrested. And I go in and I get a physical. And I find out that I'm pregnant. And I'm on my way to the penitentiary. They sentence me. And I'm on my way to the penitentiary with my son growing on the inside of me. And I'll tell you what, that's the only reason why I didn't lose my mind, because I rubbed my stomach and I talked to that child every day. And I said, I'm going to do everything I can to be a good mother. And I meant that from the bottom of my heart. I meant it. When I got my freedom, my son was 4 years old. He was with my parents. He was four. And I got on that bus from that penitentiary and seeing just the powerfulness of the disease of alcoholism. I got on that bus and all the way down the highway, all I could think about was seeing my baby. I got to the Greyhound bus station and suddenly, it said more about alcoholism. The thought crossed my mind that I hadn't had a drink in a while. If you read it, if you're new in the room and you read more about alcoholism, it talks about a guy that once seen and went to see something about a concern he once had, and suddenly the thought crossed his mind that he could put a little whiskey in his milk. Then the line after that says that he sensed he wasn't being a bit too smart. Right. That's how it was for me. And if you're new in the room, that's in italics. My sponsor told me I'm to read the book, but if it's in italics, read it twice. And that's what that said. And suddenly the thought crossed my mind. I hadn't had a drink in a while. And I went up to that bar to see my friends. And the next time I saw my child, he was 10 years old. I don't know about you, but when I was drunk downtown Cincinnati in those bars, as desperately as I wanted to go home and see my child, what would the explanation be? What would I tell them? I was drunk. No, you couldn't tell my parents that. So you know what I did? I didn't do anything. I just didn't go. So I continued drinking, doing my thing, going back and forth to the penitentiary. Coming out long enough to drink, you know what they labeled me? They said I was institutionalized. That I would always live in an institution. And you know what? Because of the fact that I left home as early as I did, I didn't have any coping or living skills. All I had was what I learned from the streets. That's one of the reasons why I'm thankful that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Because if I had to act a particular way, I would have never stayed. And I had that desire to stop drinking. Going back and forth, boom, get out of jail, get drunk, hang out. But see, the one secret that I had that nobody knew was that I had this thing for women. I'm from a family of Baptist ministers. Who was I going to tell? Who was I going to tell? It was the topic in most of my people's churches every Sunday. So you know what I did? I just was lost. I didn't know who to go to about this. All I knew is that when I looked at women, I wasn't sure that my sister looked at them the same way. And it was okay with me if I just found one and I just left this whole deal, that secret that I had. I go back to penitentiary, I get out, drink a little bit, boom, I get pregnant again. I have a daughter, and I need to tell you that I didn't get 1 ounce of prenatal care with my daughter. I drank my whole pregnancy. Not one day did I go to the doctor, and I'm a believer in angels. They've been put in my path because I met this guy and his wife, really great people, and they said that they were going to Bloomington, Indiana to open up a restaurant, and they asked me if I wanted to go with them, and I said, yeah. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt that when this baby was born, that I was going to walk away from that hospital while she was there. And I ended up going with these people, and I went into labor, and my daughter was extremely small, and it had already been set up for her to go to an adoptive family. And when you give away a child, when you're about to have it, they throw this tarp over you, and they take the baby so you can't see it. But I saw her hair, and I just thought to myself, I just wish I could just do something, be her mother. Be my son's mother. And I wanted to desperately, you guys. I wanted to desperately. I thought about my kids all the time. I think about my kids all the time today. I'm just so grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I got to come here and find a different way to live. I'm just extremely grateful. So my mother and father find out where I am in Bloomington, Indiana, and they call the hospital, and they said that she has next of kin that would be willing to take her. And so my mother said, Angie, just bring her home. So I got on this Greyhound bus with this little baby girl. And I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know what to do. And I just prayed. I said, God, please just don't let her cry. Just don't let her cry. And that whole trip, 4-hour trip, my daughter didn't make one sound. There were times I had to lift her up just to make sure that she was breathing. And I got to Cincinnati to the Greyhound bus station, and there were my parents. And they were my dad's pickup truck, and my father got out of the car, and he came, and he took her out of my arms, and he said, Angie, we got her now. And I said, what am I supposed to do? And they said, we don't know what you're supposed to do. But she didn't ask for this. And my parents drove off with my daughter. And from that day forward, all I did was drink. Every opportunity I got. I'm in this bar drinking. I was living at this boarding house on the Ohio River by now. I had nowhere else to go. And I'm living in this boarding house, and one day I went uptown to drink, and I got drunk, and I was ended up in a shooting gallery, and somebody had shot ice water into my veins. And I left that place, and I walked 17 blocks down to the boarding house where I was staying. And I got to the front door, and there was a little white woman standing there, and she looked at me, and she said, honey, you don't have to keep living like that. And I said, I'm sick, and I need somebody to help me. She went up to my room, and she put a rag on my head, and she began to tell me about her drinking. And she asked me if I would go somewhere with her, and I said, absolutely. I would have went anywhere with anybody if it could have made me feel better. And she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went to this clubhouse, and when I got sober, it wasn't a lot of African-American people. Well, kind of like it is tonight. And there wasn't a lot of African-American people in, and when we they used to park their Harleys out front, so it was like 200 Harleys parked out front, and all these white people with white cups, and they were all happy, some guys playing the guitar, singing John Denver songs, and I remember thinking to myself, well, at least they're friendly, because I was walking up the walk, and he was like, hey, welcome, welcome, welcome. And they were all friendly, and then we got up to the top step, and this big biker dude grabbed me. And he goes, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Squirrel. And I was like, Squirrel, man, you got to put me down, bruh. And why they name you Squirrel? You know what I mean? And so I went into this room, and she said, some guy's getting ready to tell his story. And this guy got up to the podium, and he just started telling y'all all kinds of stuff. I was flipping appalled. I couldn't believe what he was saying. I said, why is this man telling these people all his business? I said, I don't understand that. You know what I mean? And then it was just like that. Everybody bust out laughing. And to me, newcomer mentality. To me, he was saying, I used to beat my wife every day. Ah! That's what I thought you guys were doing. And I slept under a bridge half my life. Ah! I said, these white people crazy. So I sat there, and it just went on. And then they passed the basket. Oh, my God. I had been in the Baptist church. I said, here we go. Here we go. I knew it had to be more than this. Now they pass in the basket. Then they pass the basket. And then all of a sudden, this guy got finished speaking, and everybody rose up to their feet clapping. And I thought, what in the world? And then they stood up and they grabbed hands and prayed. I was like, oh my God. And they hypocrites too. And then they put their, you know, their hands, you know, and they were just doing this thing. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Get. And I was like, what are they saying? Keep coming back. It jerks if you squirt it. I don't know. You know. I don't know, but I guess it was the, you know, the cult handshake or whatever. And so afterwards, she said, it's customary that we go and we thank the speaker. I said, well, good, because I got a couple questions I want to ask him. So I get up to him, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, little lady. I said, look here, man. You know your audience, they laughing at you. He goes, excuse me? I said, your people, your friends, your buddies. They laughing at you, man. They laughing at your story. They laughing at everything you just said. And he said, well, you keep coming back, sugar. I said, oh, no. You keep coming back. I just heard your story. I don't know what this organization is, but apparently you need to be up on the front row. I stayed around Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while. It wasn't like I had a huge social schedule or anything. And about this time, they started coming into AA with this little crack problem. I know you don't have it here. They start coming in, and everybody weighed the same thing. And, you know, it's like they started coming in. Crack. What is that? What is wrong with you? Why do all six of you guys weigh 60 pounds? Oh, okay, I get it. So you guys get together and go, you 60 pounds? You 60 pounds? Let's go to AA. You know what I mean? And I'm telling you to tell you this. I was that person that ran around Alcoholics Anonymous going, they don't belong here. They shouldn't be here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember telling them at a table because I kept them all at a back table. I said, maybe one day they'll come up with a Crackaholics Anonymous. But right now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I judged them, and I did. I judged them because I was listening to what you guys were saying about, you know, singleness of purpose and yada, yada, yada. And here I am judging people who needed help. Judging people who, they didn't do a thing but come through the door. But me and my self-righteous self, you can stay here, but don't, you know, I'll be your sponsor. And I'm telling you to tell you this. I stayed around Alcoholics Anonymous one day when the cloud on the horizon. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that somebody else could probably use this seat. Somebody who's really sick. And I left out. And when I left out that front door of that clubhouse, drinking was not on my mind. I didn't even want to drink. But see, you were talking about God using you as an instrument. I said, you know what? I think God using me as an instrument too. I think he want me to go find some black people and bring them into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to the 8:30 meeting because I was wanting to give my departure speech. And I went to the 8:30 meeting and they asked if there was any AA related announcements. They said, yes, Angie. I said, well, look here, I'm going to roll on about it here. Thank you for the real big book and everything. And I hope that y'all know that drinking is bad for you. And it's an old timer. You know how sensitive they can be. He goes, well, get out of here then. There's people trying to stay sober. We'll see you if you make it back. I was like, oh, Mr. Oldtimer. It's been a long time, hasn't it? And I grabbed that big book, and I left out that front door. And I said, the first African-American person I see who appears to be drunk, I'm going to help him. Because I've been in AA as long as I have, and I know something. And I got on the bus. And a brother gets on staggering. I said, bingo. So I took that big book and I slid over next to him. I said, look here, brother, you been drinking? He said, yeah, I had a little something, something. I said, you know what? You may be an alcoholic. He said, I ain't no alcoholic. So he started cussing me. I said, you know, the people at the AA club told me you probably react like this to my information. So I said, I'm going to have to just give you my information the only way that you can receive it and the only way that I know how to give it. So I opened up that big book to chapter 5, and I got up out of my seat, and I got in the aisle, and I said, rarely
I said, did you hear what I said? I said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Listen up. I said, those who do not recover are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are some unfortunates. They are not at fault. And the bus driver said, look, the bus driver said, oh, hell no. Nah. He said, you got to get off this bus, sister. And I told him he was an alcoholic, too. You know what I mean? And I went down to the little bar that I used to go to. And I said, you know, I went in there and they was on the dance floor dancing. But, I'd been in AA. I knew that they was all in pain. You know what I'm saying? So I went over and I unplugged the plug of the jukebox. I said, listen, black alcoholics, they got a place for you. It's called the AA Club. And you too can get sober and you don't have to drink anymore. And they said, well, what are you doing down here? I said, oh, I graduated. I said, but you don't need to worry about me. What you need to do is, I know you hurting on the inside. And they said, girl, if you don't plug that jukebox up, we will shoot you. And so I climbed up on the bar, and I opened up that big book to chapter 5. And I stood there with my big book with the leather cover, with the coin on the inside. And I said, rarely. Did you hear what I said? I said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I said, those who do not recover are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with them. And the bar owner goes, oh, hell to the gnaw. You got to get out of here. So I stood outside reading the book to the passerbyers, and suddenly the thought crossed my mind. You know, Angie, you've been working so hard in this AA thing. You've done your service work. You've done everything, Angie. How's about a drink? But remember, we can only have one. If you're new in the room, that's the trick of the game with Alcoholics Anonymous and the disease. Let me tell you. The disease of alcoholism is so tricky, so cunning. It convinced me that I could have one. I've never had one. But that's what it tells me. I can have one. And I went back in that bar, and I ordered that drink, and I drank it. And 45 minutes later, I was in a crack house. That was for them, the weak people. But I'm going to tell you something, what I've learned in my recovery. That anytime I stand in judgment of one of God's children, that what I've done is just written myself a meal ticket to experience it on some level in my life. And I judged, I was a judge. Everybody, you, black, white, it didn't matter. And what I found out was it was because of the way that I felt about myself. And I'll tell you what, you guys, I went back out and you told me it would get worse, never better. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, June the 20th, 1991. I weighed 85 pounds. My hair was matted to my head. I had had the same clothes on for a month. I was properly horrified and thoroughly convinced that I could not put alcohol in my system. And I came back in here with all the shame and the guilt that we come back in with when we come in. And I'll be forever grateful to those members of Alcoholics Anonymous who said, welcome back, Angie. Welcome back. You're going to die if you don't do something, baby. You got to do something. And that old timer went to that shelf and he pulled that book off for me. He said, I want you to go out to that door and you shake hands. And I said, look at me. I'm stinking and I'm dirty. He said, you go shake hands. And I stood at that door with all the shame I could, and I reached my hand out, and people walked past me because of the way that I looked. But we can't get too good in here. We can't get too good in Alcoholics Anonymous where that person that may seem a little crazy, a little funky, a little dirty, because they could be your next Florida Roundup speaker. So I came on back into AA, and I did the things that my sponsor suggested for me to do. I started going to meetings every day. I was in a big book meeting in the evening at 12 and 12 at noon. I was in meetings every single day, just sitting and listening, looking for that guidance that I needed because I was scared now. And I started just, days turned into weeks, turned into months, turned into years. I am still amazed. I'm amazed that you guys think my story is any better than anybody else's. Because you know what? When I get off this stage, man, I'm just Angie. I don't think my story's that different. But I'll tell you what, I am amazed every single time somebody call me and ask me to speak. I am amazed and shocked. Because I was in the gutter. I was sleeping outside on park benches, eating out of garbage cans. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, man, and you guys told me to come on in. Come on in, Angie. You can do this. You can do this. I didn't have a place, so I'm the wrong person to talk to if you're coming to AA and you ain't got a place to stay, because I didn't have a place to stay when I got sober. But they told me, you keep coming back and your life is going to change more than you'll ever know. I haven't had to sleep outside since the day I got sober. Because members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me into their home. White people. I mean, they was putting their purses up in the deepest, darkest cabinet. But they let me stay. And I'll be forever, forever grateful. So I started working these steps, man. You know what I mean? Got with my sponsor, began to look at that powerlessness, began to look at that insanity, looking at step three and getting on my knees with my sponsor and saying the third step prayer. I couldn't even pray, but my sponsor prayed for me. She prayed it with me. I couldn't even read when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, y'all. Thank God for big book meetings, because I was the one in there stuttering over the words, didn't know what they meant, and you guys softly and gently told me what the words meant. You told me what the words meant. And you said you just keep coming back, Angie. You come back to this meeting, we'll help you read every single time. Today I sit in meetings and somebody can't read, and I see people have the nerve to be impatient. When it says love and tolerance is our code. It's our code. I don't ever want to get that well where I can't help somebody who's less fortunate than myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really, truly don't. So one day I was sitting at a meeting and this girl was talking about going to college. I actually had a diploma, but I had made it in college. I mean, not in college, I had made it in prison. So it was in my personnel file. So she was talking about going to college. And I was like, I wonder if I could go to college. And then God said to me, you know that little voice you hear on the inside? He said, not with that fake diploma you want. And I went to my sponsor and I said, my boss got a fake diploma. And she said, you need to go get it from him. And I said, I've been to penitentiary 5 times. He gonna fire me and I need this job. She said, you go tell him anyway. So I went to my boss and I was like, that diploma in my file is fake. And he went to my file and he opened it up and he pulled it out and he held it up. He said, you good. He said, but you can't work here without a high school education. And I said, are you going to fire me? And he said, no, I'm going to give you 6 months to get it. 6 months to get it. And so wait a minute now. I'm sitting in my living room and all of a sudden this commercial comes on that says, you too can get your high school diploma on TV. And I was like, that's it. So I sent a little money in and they sent me the books and I studied and I passed the test and I had to go through all that science and math and all that stuff. And I took the last test and I passed it. And when they sent me my grades, I went and I signed up for the equivalency of a diploma, took the test, and I got a perfect score. Man, that may not be a lot to some people, but man, that was huge for me. And when that diploma came in the mail, December the 7th, 1999, I grabbed it and I fell back on my bed and I said, I'm going to college. And I called the University of Cincinnati and I went up to admissions and I said, I want to go to college. And they said, what is it that you want to do, ma'am? I said, I don't know. That's what you here for. So at this time, they had incorporated the School of Addiction Studies into the University of Cincinnati. And I took that, and I now have a liberal arts and social sciences certificate in addiction studies. And I have just a few more classes, and I'll be finished with my bachelor's. But I want to tell you guys something real quick. I want to tell you that, you know, I did this thing, and I you know, worked the steps, and I continue to work the steps. But I want to tell you about my children. My daughter is now 21, and she attends the Grambling State University in Louisiana. And at about 3 years sober, my family asked me if I would just stay out of their lives and let my children have the same opportunities that I had. And for the first time in my life, somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous said, Angie, you got an opportunity to do something selfless right now. Let them kids go. They'll be back. But let them go. And I let them go. But I had to do something. See, I had to be at their games. I was at his soccer games. And I was at her soccer games. And I would sit at the back of the field with sunglasses on and a hat. But I had to see my kids. On my daughter's 18th birthday, she called me and said she wanted to see me. And I went and I picked her up and we went to the mall. And she spent all my damn money. She spent every dime I had. And I realized something in my prayers. I said, you know, I'm going to have to be a little more specific. You know, I said I wanted to see her, but I wanted to, you know, should have said, and I'd like to keep a little change in my pocket too. You know what I mean? And you know, we got back in the car and I was taking her back and she asked me, she said, Angie, are you okay? And I said, yeah. I said, I'm doing good, Whitney. And she said, Mama told me that you had some problems with drugs and alcohol, and that's why you didn't have this. And I said, yeah, that's true. I said, but I must tell you that there hasn't been a day that I didn't think about you. I wanted to be there, but I just couldn't. I got this thing called alcoholism, and I just couldn't be there. I dropped her back off at home, and I was driving. I was able to make some amends to her, and I was driving back. And I started feeling a little bit of self-pity, but then I remembered. My prayer was answered. My prayer was answered. She called me when she was going to Grambling State, and she said, would you take me to the airport? And I took her to the airport, and she had her head on my shoulder. And we just rode like we'd never been separated. And I got to the airport, and she got her bags and everything checked in. And I said, I love you, Whitney. And she said, I love you too, Angie. And she walked away. And I was like, man, thank God I didn't get what I deserved. Because if I got what I deserved, my kids wouldn't speak to me. Oh, yeah. And she's dating a white guy. I don't care who you are. You hear some news like that, you're going to have some thoughts about it. His name's Jeremy. How white is that? Jeremy. My son always goes, hey, Jeremy, where's Jake and Josh? Anyway. So my son, he's in jail as I speak to you. He's 24, and he's, I believe, one of us. And I'll tell you what. I had to go and take a little shot at Al-Anon because I wanted to get him out. I didn't want him to spend a day in there because I knew what I went through in prison. I knew. I said, I got to go get him. And my sponsor said, my Al-Anon sponsor said, no, you don't. Because if you went to go get him, you'd be getting him to make yourself feel better. That's no lesson to him. I wanted to go bad. So he calls me. And he said, come and get me. And I said, I can't do it. Because you got to go on your own journey. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because what I found out is that I no longer have to be worried about your journey. I need to be concerned with my journey. So that's where he is. But I'm going to close with this, you guys. Back home, my grandmother, she used to rock in this rocking chair. And she used to hum this song. And I never, ever knew the meaning of it until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to close with this, if you don't mind. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. See, I once was lost, ooh, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. God bless you.